You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Barney Rossett is perhaps best known as the publisher who dared to print unexpurgated versions of D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover and Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer. He led landmark legal battles that revolutionized American obscenity laws, ensuring that even sexually explicit material, so long as it had some social value, was protected by the First Amendment. Tomorrow evening, Mr. Rossett will be one of five people honored by the National Coalition Against Censorship, and he's here now, along with two of the other First Amendment advocates being honored at this annual celebration of free speech, journalists Ruth Gruber and Anthony Lewis, and they all join us now. Welcome to our show.
Hello.
Let's begin with you, Ruth. You started reporting for the New York Herald Tribune in 1935. What changes have you seen regarding censorship over the years? Do reporters have more freedoms now than they used to?
I think they have more freedoms, and I think that they reveal a lot more than they did in the early years. For instance, nobody ever mentioned the fact that FDR couldn't use his legs. When you went to one of his press conferences, he was already sitting behind the desk, so that nobody mentioned that. There were some things...
But that's self-censorship.
That there were several things that nobody touched. And if we knew they had a girlfriend, you never mentioned that.
What got you censored the first time?
Well, the biggest censor was that my book, Exodus, was not ever printed in England. For 61 years, it was censored.
And they finally published it only last year?
Right, in December last year.
And why?
And they decided it was time that the British should know that story. And so they asked me to fly over to London and help promote it. And one of the reporters burst into tears and said, "It's my story, it's our story," and they wouldn't even teach it to us.
Well, that was about Jewish refugees aboard the Exodus who were denied admission to British-occupied Palestine. Were your stories published in this country?
Yes. The Herald Tribune gave them full play, and they were syndicated all over the United States.
So what was the argument that the British gave for not allowing it for all those years?
They gave no argument. It just was not done. But now, having published it, they are on their knees practically begging forgiveness. And every single one of the articles says how shamefully they acted.
Anthony Lewis, you've worked for the New York Times since 1948, won two Pulitzer Prizes, one for national reporting and one for your reporting on the U.S. Supreme Court. Did you experience any censorship along the way?
Not really. Not outside, and most crucially to me, not inside the paper. The columnists were given very free rein by the publisher, Arthur Ochs Sulzberger, and it was an amazing freedom.
Even before you started writing op-ed pieces?
Ah, yes, I see what you mean. No, as a reporter, there were constraints. Editors decided what was fit to print. That was the Times slogan, all the news that's fit to print. And occasionally I would run into something, but I don't really remember it because I was covering the Supreme Court much of that time, and with one signal exception, the Supreme Court didn't say things that were censorable.
I have spoken to reporters who have covered wars and told me that they would send in a story and then be surprised by what appeared in the newspaper or the magazine, something quite different sometimes.
Yes, of course, that's true, because what soldiers say and survive in war is not very nice. Often, expletive and unpleasant and bloody, and the editors want to protect the reader. The exception, I'm not even sure I can say this on the air, so I'd better not. There was a Supreme Court case that used one of those seven dirty words, and it was said in court, but I'm not sure I can say it on the air.
No, you can't. Not until after midnight. And
I'm glad you warned me.
Your latest book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment, was just released. Do you think we face a renewed threat to our First Amendment rights today?
I actually don't. I think we have the threat in the civil libertarian sphere that most concerns me is the Bush administration's assumption of enormous presidential power. It claims the right to torture people, to eavesdrop on them, wiretap, and all without any power in either Congress or the courts, according to the president's lawyers, to restrain those activities. That's very worrying to me, but it's not an old-fashioned First Amendment case. There are still some cases in which the Bush administration is trying to stop obscenity and so on, but they're rather marginal.
Bonnie Rossett, what was the publishing industry like in the late 50s and early 60s? What were you up against when you first tried to publish Lady Chatterley's Lover?
Well, as I was brand new to the industry, I didn't really know what I was up against. But what I really wanted to publish was Tropic of Cancer, which I had read as a freshman at Swarthmore College.
In a smuggled edition? Had been published in France?
No. Well, probably smuggled, but I bought it at the Gotham Book Mart in New York. I bought it because I had received another book of Miller's called Cosmological Eye. And in that book, one of the essays was on Tropic of Cancer, and I found it to be fascinating, not because of its sexual content, but because of its criticism of the American culture and what it meant to him and how he detested it. And that he felt terrible about having to come to live here because the war was just starting in Europe. And so I wrote a paper on it then, and then many years later, when I sort of found myself in publishing, a few blocks from here, where we are right now, I decided that was a book I very much wanted to legitimatize here, and I set about doing it, and it took quite a long time.
That was Grove Press. Why did it take a long time? Because you had to get it cleared by lawyers?
No, not by lawyers, by police. I started with Lady Chatterley's Lover because I felt that that was more of a known quantity, and D.H. Lawrence was known as a very good writer. And the University of California, Mark Shore, who's the head of the English department, came to me and said, why don't you publish this book? And I thought it provided the ideal beginning for Tropic of Cancer, and through that, the right to read.
Well, that book, Lady Chatterley's Lover, had been published in a number of different versions. Some were more explicit than others. Which one did you choose?
We chose the one that Lawrence himself published in Italy.
That was 1928. He self-published it.
Yes, he did. And Mark Shore was an expert on it and a very close friend of Lawrence's wife, Frida, who lived in New Mexico. He even went down to New Mexico to Taos to check out the version with her, and I spoke to her many times. And we had a big problem, mainly with American publishers. Knopf had published an expurgated version, and we have laws which, if you publish something that is considered illegal, the part that's illegal becomes out of copyright. So it's a double punishment. So we had to fight our way through that because it enabled anybody to publish it once we got the legal right. But we did, and after that, Tropic of Cancer followed.
But did you have to fight censorship in the courts?
Yes, we went.
I mean, you were a small press, and yet you were going all the way to the Supreme Court with a case.
Yes, we were. And it took took a long time, and we discovered that even after you win in the Supreme Court, there are states in this country which ignore such a decision. So we had to go out and continue fighting in various states.
My guests are Barney Rossett, Ruth Gruber, and Anthony Lewis. I'm talking to three of the five recipients of a special award being given this year by the National Coalition Against Censorship. And this comes not long after the American Library Association has observed Banned Books Week, which celebrates the freedom to choose and express opinions no matter how unpopular. It does seem surprising, doesn't it, in an age when everyone can view anything online, whether it's pornography or hate group propaganda, that people are still concerned about taking certain books out of the library. And it usually winds up books like something by Mark Twain or J.D. Salinger or Judy Blume. In your case, Ruth, a book that was a work of history was kept out of the British public's hands for, you said, 60, how many years?
61 years. And when they finally published it last December, the reviews were incredible. They had huge headlines. One of them described one of the prison ships on which 1,500 of the 4,500 refugees aboard the original Exodus. They had been transferred to three ships, and I was allowed to go aboard one of them. And when they allowed me on the Runnymede Park, I met these refugees again. And the reporters described how they had been forced into the hold of that prison ship. And the headline said, "I saw Jews forced into ships from Dante's hell." Imagine a headline like that in America. And the first paragraph was how shamefully the British had acted.
So the government was just protecting itself.
Yes.
Anthony, doesn't it an offensive book seem almost quaint by today's standards? Pretty much everything is available, isn't it? Do you think that most of the instances of censorship today are self-censorship, or editors modifying a story, as we said earlier, or because of concerns of negative audience response or of offending the advertisers?
Probably that's true, but don't forget we still have a nanny Federal Communications Commission that tried to punish a network with a vast fine for a scene that it couldn't anticipate and had nothing to do with, namely the bearing of Janet Jackson's breast, the wardrobe malfunction, famous wardrobe malfunction. And the FCC still polices those seven dirty words. You told me I couldn't say one of them till after midnight.
Well, I could get into a lot of trouble, and the station could get in a lot of trouble.
That shows you that censorship in some quarters is alive and well.
But on the other hand, there are people who would say we are a broadcast in the middle of the day when anyone can be listening, including children, and perhaps we should be more careful about what we say at this time rather than later in the evening.
Yes, perhaps you should, but that should be your choice, not the Federal Communications choice.
What about hate speech? Do you think that should ever be censored?
You know, it's a most difficult question for me. We are the only country that protects hate speech, that is, vicious, lying calumnies about religious or racial groups, ethnic groups, and so on. Canada, our next-door neighbor, which also has a constitutional clause protecting freedom of speech, allowed the Supreme Court of Canada allowed the prosecution of a Holocaust denier. In this country, a Holocaust denier can spout his rubbish all he wants, and he can't be prosecuted. It's a very hard question for me, and I think hate speech can cross a line if it seems likely to cause actual harm, that is, attacks on people.
Well, actually, it's come up during this political campaign because some people have been yelling, "Kill him," about Barack Obama during Sarah Palin's speeches.
I agree, and Frank Rich
but what
had a
do
very
we do?
Good column about that in the New York Times. It's horrible. And those people who cry kill him can be prosecuted, even under our constitutional laws, and in my opinion should be.
What about those people who give misinformation about, in this case, Barack Obama's background, claiming that he's actually secretly a Muslim and a jihadist? Fox News actually broadcast a TV special in which those claims were made.
You're talking about the Sean Hannity show?
Yes.
Well, I thought it was disgraceful, and disgraceful that such a thing should go on the air with the approval, apparently, at least in retrospect, of Rupert Murdoch, the owner of Fox News. And, you know, Sean Hannity relied on a man who was a noted anti-Semite, a lunatic fringer, and claimed, well, it was just his opinion. And, I'm not now talking about censorship as such, but simply about responsibility. Is it responsible? Is it sane to put on the air a program based on a nutcase? Not to me, it isn't.
My guests are Anthony Lewis, who is a former New York Times columnist, still writes once in a while for the Times. His latest book is Freedom for the Thought We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. Also here is Barney Rossett, publisher, one of America's legendary publishers, and Ruth Gruber, a journalist and author. And we've been talking about her book, which is called Exodus 1947, censored for many years, in fact, until last year in Britain. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Later in this hour, Egyptian author Ala Alaswani will talk about his new novel about post 9/11 Chicago. And in our second hour, photographer Susan Micellus, and then actor and comedian Richard Belzer, who's played Detective Munch on a number of different TV series. Now he's written a novel starring Detective Munch. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Now our entire show is available as a podcast.
WNYC support comes from Uni Data and Communications, part of the Unity International Group, providing information technology solutions tailored to client business objectives, including desktop-managed services, unidataIT.com. Hofstra University, where students can pursue 140 undergraduate programs. Fall open house Sunday, October 26. More at 1-800-HOFSTRA or hofstra.edu. Symphony Space, presenting The Thalia Follies, a political cabaret at last, an election, with Emmy Award-winning actress Jane Curtin on October 23rd to October 25th. Ticket information, 212-864-5400 or symphonyspace.org.
Thanks to everyone who responded to this morning's All the Money in Half the Time Monday Challenge. The second half of the day is pledge-free. But if you haven't made a pledge, your support right now will pay for the Leonard Lopate Show and all the other shows you enjoy on WNYC, about $75. And we'll throw in the latest Zagat Guide, or $120, and we will give you a year subscription to The New Yorker. Go to our website, WNYC.org, right now, or call us at 1-888-376-9692. We're back with Barney Rossett, Ruth Gruber, and Anthony Lewis, three of the five people being honored by the National Coalition Against Censorship tomorrow evening. We're talking about the First Amendment and the future of the First Amendment. And Anthony, what do you think the Supreme Court is heading on First Amendment rights? How does the Roberts Court compare to the courts of the past?
First Amendment rights are now so solidified in our constitutional law. You mentioned earlier that we're past the age of trying to ban novels like the one that Barney Rossett had the courage to publish, and more honor to him for that, Tropic of Cancer. But not just that, but lots of serious novels.
Well, Lady Chatterley's Lover, he's also published other books that were under attack.
Yes, but Beckett. You know, even before that, they tried to ban, and did ban for many years, James Joyce's Ulysses. We were a very prurient-minded society, and we're not that anymore. So I think there is a general sense on the Supreme Court that people should be allowed to say what they want and read what they want. It's not perfect, but it's much better than it used to be.
You've written a lot about reporters and source confidentiality. In the light of the Judith Miller case, do you remain a purist on that matter?
I don't think I've ever been a purist because unlike many of my colleagues and certainly press lawyers, I don't think that there's an automatic privilege for journalists who want to keep their sources secret. I give you the case of Wen-Ho Lee, who was a scientist at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. The press began writing stories that he was a Chinese spy. He lost his job. He was indicted, charged with 50 serious felonies, including espionage. And then the government dropped 49 of the 50, and he pleaded out to the last and was let off with a small fine. And he sued the government for violation of his privacy in the false leaks about what he had done. And he asked the press to say who the leaker was. The press naturally wouldn't say. And in the end, when he got an order from the court that they had to say, the New York Times and various networks settled the case by paying him a large sum of money. Now, my question is, do we want to have a society in which the press can destroy a man's life, which is what they did to Wen-Ho Lee, and not be held accountable for it? I don't want that society.
Barney, Neil Ortenberg and Daniel O'Connor produced a documentary about you called Obscene. How did you like that title applied to you?
I didn't like it. The title that I had given to it and to a book which I've been writing was the subject is left-handed. And that was a heading of a document put out that the FBI had put out for itself. And
you mean you're left-handed? Yes. You were the subject?
I was the subject.
And why was that even relevant, whether you were left-handed or right-handed?
Well, I don't know, but it's actually been amusing me a great deal because I think there is something to it. There is something wrong about left-handed people.
Well, maybe they were paying you a left-handed compliment.
Maybe they were. But before I got around it, Fred Jordan of Grove Press and I, many years ago, for some reason, felt totally dependent upon the word of Anthony Lewis. And I can remember waiting outside at night, whether it was Washington, D.C. or New York, I'm not sure. And we were waiting for him to tell Mr. Lewis about some problem we were having because we felt he was the only person whom we could speak to in the press who would understand what we were talking about.
Ruth, they're making a documentary about you now.
Yes.
Because of what happened in Britain last year?
I don't think that's the reason. Just
because you've had this incredible career.
Well, but I want to tell you about the New Yorker. When I got back from covering the exodus and the prison ships.
That was 1948?
48. Sean of the New Yorker, the editor everybody loved that story. And he edited the whole manuscript, was just about to send it to the printer when his boss, Raoul Fleischman, said, "Oh, no, we can't print this in the New Yorker. It's too Jewish."
There were rumors that the same sort of thing happened at the New York Times, Tony, that there were concerns at times that a story might be too Jewish, and because the owners were Jewish, that it might wind up exploding in their faces.
I've read those suggestions. I don't have any personal knowledge of it, but it is true that for whatever reason, and shockingly so in the light of history, the New York Times downplayed the story of the Holocaust when the news of what had happened to the Jews of Europe began coming across, as it did before we actually defeated the Germans. The New York Times either didn't run any story or buried it back in the back of the paper in small little stories.
My guests are Anthony Lewis, Ruth Gruber, and Barney Rossett, three of the recipients of the National Coalition Against Censorship Award tomorrow night. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Barney, in addition to being honored by the National Coalition Against Censorship tomorrow, the National Book Foundation is giving you a Lifetime Achievement Award in November. You've never been one to follow convention. Have you been moved by... Are you no longer considered an avant-garde publisher these days? Have you become a member of the establishment receiving all these awards?
I really don't know whether that's a coincidence or.
Did you have to wait all these years to make it into the mainstream, Barney?
I don't think I've gotten there yet, but I'm still trying.
How did you wind up creating Grove Press in the first place?
Well, I actually had nothing to do with. I was a photographer, and in the Army I made film in China, India. After the war, I was in Chicago and started making documentary films. And later I got married to somebody I went to school with, a progressive school in Chicago, Joan Mitchell, who became very well known as an expressionist painter. So I really was more part of the world of photography and political interest. And a small company had started on Grove Street, right near here, as a matter of fact, where the studio is now. And these two young men had published three books, and then they went broke. And a friend of my wife brought them to me and said, why don't you take this on? And it seemed to be a part of my life. Anyway, I did, right at 57 West 9th Street. And it just seemed to me to be a natural flow of life.
Well, you made it a point to publish authors that others wouldn't touch, Samuel Beckett, Che Guevara, Malcolm X, and had successes with all of them. So were you proving a point that the more established publishers were not understanding until, I guess eventually they understood it, when they saw the sales of these books?
I don't know at all. But one nice story I was just thinking of was Bennett Cerf of Random House, who published Ulysses here, which you mentioned before and which he was very proud of. And when we started to publish Lady Chatterley's Lover, he said that was ridiculous, it was a frivolous book, it didn't mean anything. But then he gradually changed his mind, and to prove it, he bought the rights from us to make it a part of the modern library. So maybe we had an influence on our superiors.
Well, the change did occur in publishing not all that long afterward. Ruth, was this the only experience you had, the Exodus story with censorship? Or
when
you were working for the Tribune, weren't there ever stories that they told you they didn't want to publish?
No, they let me write almost anything. And in fact, there was a wonderful coincidence. A few months ago, I was asked to fly to Israel for the International Film Festival, and the Exodus was the reason. And there was this incredible coincidence. The day that we drove to Haifa, the director, Bob, said to me, we're going to have you stand on the dock where you stood when you watched that battered ship Exodus come into Palestine, as it was then called. And on the way there, I said, what do you think? Today is Friday, July 13th, 2008, and I stood on the same dock Friday, July 18th, 1947. And it was the most thrilling moment for us because the water was beautiful. The port in 47 was a little tiny port. Today, you're going to see it in this documentary they're making, it's like three football fields, and there are huge high-rise buildings all around, and they're all, I guess, being pictured now. But the fascinating thing about being in Haifa exactly the same day,
61 years later.
Yes.
A listener writes in, we can't have it both ways. In order to make informed decisions, we need to have all the information, even if it's information we don't like. I suspect all three of you would agree with that statement.
Yes, I do, and it's exactly what James Madison thought and said when he wrote the First Amendment.
So why do we keep on forgetting it? Not long after James Madison wrote that, there were already laws being written to cut back on that right.
It's one of the mysteries of American history. 7 years after the First Amendment, Congress, under the control of the Federalist Party, passed a law making it a crime to criticize the president. But the public rejected it. There was an election 2 years later. The public did not vote for the incumbent, John Adams. It elected Jefferson, who had been a very strong, indeed bitter critic of the Sedition Act. In effect, the public said it was unconstitutional.
Well, the public seems to go different ways at different times. It voted John Adams out for the Alien and Sedition Acts, but the public has supported censorship over the years as well, and then objected to censorship. I suspect at this point it would be hard for a Supreme Court to go back on some of the things that have been established over the years, but it's not impossible, is it?
No, it's not impossible, and the implication of your question is correct. In the end, it depends not on the courts, but on us. If Americans become less tolerant and are going to start thinking, well, we're not safe, we've got to stop people saying dangerous things, the courts on the whole, in the long run, will reflect that opinion, and I hope it doesn't happen. I don't think it will, but we have to be on guard, and that's why we have outfits like the National Coalition Against Censorship.
Barney, you must be proud for the role that you played in opening up First Amendment rights.
Well, I am, but it's something that I couldn't have stopped from within myself. But one thing I noticed today, and it's not of one political party, and it is a tendency in the American public and the American political figures to constantly repeat that we are the greatest country in the world. It seems to me that when people are reduced to claiming that they are the, so to speak, God's given children, that there's a deep feeling of fear and inferiority.
We have to leave it there. Thank you so much, all three of you, Barney Rossett, Ruth Gruber, Anthony Lewis, all being honored by the National Coalition Against Censorship tomorrow night. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show. And as I just said, Ruth Gruber, Barney Rossett, and Anthony Lewis are being honored on October 21st tomorrow by the National Coalition Against Censorship at its annual celebration of free speech and its defenders. For more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Up next, somebody who's had to fight for free speech in another country, Egyptian author Ala al-Aswani, talking about his new novel about clashing cultures in post-9/11 Chicago.